that right?
That is right.
Number of survivors. Congratulations. So what I want to do today is the first hour we'll go through this sparse diagonalization. In the end, it's just going to be a bit more on what we discussed on Wednesday of how to manipulate wave functions by multiplying them with a Hamiltonian without ever building the Hamiltonian as a full metric. And then the second part, I will just give you some talk, which corresponds to some colloquium I've given in the past, and just take it easy and ask answer questions along the way. Very good. So remember the idea. We want to multiply the Hamiltonian times a vector. Our Hamiltonian is the sum of local terms acting on two spins at a time. And so what we're going to do, or what we did, was to multiply each term individually so that we never had any need to build the full Hamiltonian, which in this notation would look like a big matrix like that. We don't have to build it. We don't need to build that. Okay? And today what I thought is I gave you some exercise, a couple of exercises that we didn't have time to finish last time on Wednesday, so I thought we would just go through them, at least through one of them first. So let's see, there is this notebook that says exact diagonalization 5, semi-complete. The semi is that last night I discovered that I don't know how to do something in Julia 1.0, so I left it on the site, and I'll tell you what it is, and maybe we'll find out how to do it later on. Okay, so remember that we could initialize the state for n spins. Last night I stopped using 20 because things were too slow, so I went to 18, but in principle you can go to 20, 22, or 20-something with your laptop. So we prepare some, this is what we did the other time, we would prepare some random state, normalize it, and use this function that multiplies the state times the two body term for all possible locations. Good. And then we just did that last time. Did you have a look at the code and are there questions about it? Okay, so that's a no yes, I guess. No, a no no. So then we can run this simulation. Remember, this is the power method. We apply the Hamiltonian to the wave function a number of times. How many times? Now I went for 300. And then we take the result. So I'm storing the energies of the state after each application of the Hamiltonian. And we plotted this last time. So this would be the energy of the state as a function of the number of times we apply the Hamiltonian to it. And you see that it drops. And then eventually, it becomes very, very stable. Okay? And that would be our approximation to the ground state energy, some value here. And the wave function, the vector that we have, would be our approximation to the ground state. Good. And then there was some homework. And the first exercise was for 20 spins. Now I'm happy to do it with 18 just to make it faster, to try it on 18. Compute the lowest energy with a given momentum. Okay? The question is, how do we do this? So if you take our state and we hit it with the Hamiltonian, it will go to the lowest energy state. Now that's not what we want. We want to consider states with a given momentum. Okay? So remember, what's a state with a given momentum? State with a given momentum is the state that you apply the translation operator to it, and you get the same state back times some phase, which is 2 pi over n times k. So this k is the momentum of this wave function. Okay? So it's a state that is not translation invariant, it's translation covariant. It develops a phase. All right? Very good. So how are we going to ensure that we are looking at the states of this form? So the idea is that we will use the same method. We'll just hit it with a Hamiltonian. But we will make sure that the state on which we hit that we hit with the Hamiltonian is an eigenstate of the translation operator. Okay? So the tendency of the algorithm is to produce the ground state. That would be ground state is A, so the ground state corresponds to k equal to 0. Okay? Because the Hamiltonian is translation invariant, the ground state is translation invariant. But now we would like to consider these other states with lowest possible energy. And so what we can do is drawn in here, is given any wave function, we can make sure we can produce, given a wave function, we can project it into a given momentum sector. What that means is that, well, let's try first, suppose that this wave function, psi, is this guy here with psi k. Okay? So, suppose it has given momentum. Then, when I translate it, it would develop a phase. When I translate it twice, when I apply t squared, there will be, this phase will be doubled, and so on. So if I take a linear combination and I put here the opposite phase, and what I'm doing here is I'm applying t minus 1. Okay? So the idea is I take psi plus t minus 1 on psi plus t minus 2 on psi, etc. Now, if this state has some phase, sorry, and I multiply it by this phase. I forgot to say that. The idea is that if the state is an eigenstate of t, of the translation operator, okay, then every time I do this, I get back the same, exactly the same state. Okay, so I translate my state and I undo the phase. It would appear, then I get back the same state. Okay. Now, suppose that the state instead doesn't have that phase. So suppose that the state is momentum 0, and here I act with these phases, which correspond to momentum 1. Then what's going to happen is that I'll get the same state all the time, psi, 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 but the phases here will be roots of the identity. I'll get 0. Say in, for n equal to 4, I'll get 4 contributions that are always the same state in front, but I'll get a phase that will be this one, this one, this one, or this one. Okay? These 4 roots of the identity. So when you add them together, you get 0. Okay? So the idea is that if you take a state and you add t times the state plus t squared times the state and so on, you are building a projection to zero momentum. If the state had zero momentum, you will get the state back. If the state had another momentum, you get 0. Okay? It's a projector to zero momentum. If that would be if we just apply the translation operator. If we put proper phases in front, then we project onto different other momenta. Okay? So, you know, this is standard. When you are used to working with it, I realize that it's not so simple if you are not familiar with it. But it's the basic idea that if you have an object that is invariant in the transformation, okay, it can be invariant or covariant, it can develop a phase or not. If you have a symmetrized version of that, it will be a projector. So let's simplify it much more. So suppose that we have a parity operator that when acting on psi can give you plus or minus psi. Okay? So what I'm saying is that we could act with P plus p squared, okay, suppose we apply p plus p squared on psi, right? And now, so suppose that this, let's say that this is a plus state, okay? So each of these gives you the same, and you end up with 1 plus 1 times psi plus, okay? But suppose you had a p minus state, so then when you apply the same object to it, what do you get? You get a minus from here and a plus from there, right? Two minuses. So you get a minus, minus 1, plus 1, times the state, and this gives you a 0. Okay, so that's how you build a projector. Now what I'm saying is the projector will be t plus t squared plus t3 all the way to tn. Okay, these translations. Okay, that will give us a projector to zero momentum. Now, similarly here, we could say, how do we project? So this is how do we build a projector into the minus? Well, we just put a minus here, and then, here. And now this is a plus, okay? And we recover the state. If we use a minus here, we'll get a zero there. Okay, so we can just have a sequence of t, t squared, t3, and so on, okay? And if we put proper phases in front, we will choose a projector onto different momenta. No phases, it's projecting into the zero momentum, okay? If we put other phases, we can project to momentum 1, momentum 2, and so on. Okay, so then that's how we're going to proceed here. We're going to build these projectors onto different momenta. Now, one thing that I could have done long time ago is to define this function here that, given a vector, it just normalizes it. So it divides the vector by its norm. Okay, I just realized I was using this everywhere, so finally decided to write the function. Now, this function here, it's this projector. So given some state, okay, and a momentum k, it will produce a new state that will be the result of taking that state and linearly combining it with its translations, adding proper phases, okay? And so then it's a projector onto momentum k. Okay? How do we do this? Well, that's actually pretty simple, in the sense that we just go around and apply this decomposition that I described here, right? So we want to add all these terms that are the result of taking the state, translating by one side, or by two sides, or by three sides, and adding proper phases. And so we can do this in a loop, and then this would be the new state. So the initial state is psi. That's the input. The psi and the momentum are the input. And what we do is we produce a new state, new psi, which is the addition of n contributions, which all of which correspond to taking psi and adding a proper phase. Now here instead of rotating psi, instead of applying these translations to psi, I just found it more convenient to apply the rotations to new psi. Okay, it's equivalent. So the idea is, I fixed my state, and I add contributions that correspond to moving around the partial sum. So if you recognize this, what we do here is we have new psi, we reshape it so that it has one leg and the rest of legs. We permute the two. That's what we saw the other day. So remember that if our goal is to, say, take this one here, the first of the spins to become the last one, we can do this by the following sequence. First, we group together these last three indices. Then we permute this big index with this one. and then we undo the reshape. Okay, so remember this was a reshape. This was a permute. So the reshape. This part here is a reshape. Then we have this part here, which is a permute dims. And then finally we have a final reshape. Okay. And you have them right here. We reshape all the indices into one index and the rest. We permute those two, and then we reshape the vector. Instead of so here what we do is indeed, I forgot to say that we always keep all the indices together. Okay, so it's a bit more complicated. So it's just convenient to work with all the indices together. So this is the starting point. Then what we do is split this in this way. So the first reshape actually was taking a single big index into two indices. So this reshape here, the original vector here is a single index of 2 to the n components, and it breaks it into 2 and 2 to the n minus 1. And the rest is as I was saying. Okay? You had a question?
I don't see where you add the t index, the transition.
Oh, it's there. It's right there. Permute. When you permute all indices but one and the other one, that's exactly the translation. Okay? Good. All right, so what happens then when, what else do we need to do? Oh yeah, and then this function simply given, this other function, compute momentum, given a vector, it just tells you how much is the scalar product of the vector with its translated version. So imagine that we have a vector psi, that when you apply t, this gives you e to the I 2 pi over n times k times psi. So if this vector had momentum k, that's what's going to happen, right? If you wanted now, given this vector, to know how much k is, you just take psi k, you apply the translation operator, and you apply psi k, right? This number here is directly e to the I 2 pi over n k. Okay? And then just take the argument of this to find out k. The argument. No, it's called angle in Julia. Angle of this number is going to be 2 pi over n times k. And so just multiply and n divide by 2 pi, and you'll get the momentum k. Okay? And that's what this function is doing. It's taking the scalar product, this scalar product, computing the angle, multiplying by n, dividing by 2 pi. Okay, so if we are given a state with well-defined momentum, and we put it in here, we'll get out the momentum. And now we can try this for, so this was just a way of testing this. So what do we do here? We start with a number of zeros. No, here. So we create some random state, and we want it to have momentum n, or n equal from 1 to capital N. And then we check, we compute its momentum, right? This is the state psi, or we call it q. And we look at its momentum, and then we plot it at the end of the process. And you see that as we loop, the answer is precisely what we wanted, momentum 1, 2, 3, 4. This is a 5, 6, 7, and 8, and so on. If you see a minus 9 and it bothers you, it's because of the angles in periodicity. Right? So this function angle, when you provide an angle, so if you have an angle theta from 0 maybe to pi, just gonna call it from 0 to pi here, and it will take this and map it into negative. So the answer of angle is between minus pi and pi. This function returns a number between minus pi and pi. Okay. All right, so that was this test. And now basically we can do the same that we did the other day. We start with some state. This time we give it a specific momentum. So we initialize, now we're going to apply this Hamiltonian. We're going to hit an initial state, psi k, with the Hamiltonian to lower its energy. But instead of starting with a random state, we start with a random state, and we make sure we project it into momentum k. So we have a well-defined momentum. And for concreteness, I consider k equal to 1 here. All right.
You have a normal distribution for the random numbers. Then you're doing all these transformations of them. Does it stay normal distributed?
Oh, no. That's me being lazy. I just want to start with some state. It doesn't really matter. Some state to which then, so this is some state, random, but it's not too important. And then I project it into having momentum k. I apply a projector to momentum k, k equal to 1 in this. And now, you know, if I wanted the ground state, I would put k equal to 0 there, because the ground state has zero momentum. Now I'm putting k equal to 1, and I'm going to start applying the Hamiltonian to this state to lower its energy. So that's just the initialization. And then this is basically the same code that we had the other day, the loop where we apply, where we multiply the state with a Hamiltonian in a sparse way, and we just compute its energy, and we store it, and we normalize, and go. Okay? So let's do that. 300 steps. And this is a bit slower. Wait, what happened here? Yes. That's pretty amazing. Did I forget to? I forgot one important step. So I'm not hitting it with, I'm not projecting it down to momentum. That's embarrassing. Anyway, so something interesting happens. If you notice here, we started with momentum 1, but after each iteration, after multiplying by the Hamiltonian, I should check whether I still have momentum 1. Okay, so let's have a look at the result, and then I'll tell you what happened. So we're almost done. We can plot the result. And we can compare how the energies look. And even though I forgot to keep projecting onto momentum 1, that was really silly, we see that the energy that we got this time for k equal to 1 is higher than the energy we got for the ground state. So that's because I got very lucky. The Hamiltonian is, you know, it's translation invariant, so it doesn't get you out of the k equal to 1, momentum 1 sector. Okay? When I hit the state with momentum 1 with a Hamiltonian, I get a new state that still has momentum 1. So in general, this is not a safe way of going, because numerical errors will produce some amplitude to momentum 0, and then it will become amplified. Okay, but luckily this didn't happen, so it's a bit less embarrassing. So that's probably why I didn't notice last night that I had forgot to project. Okay? But the idea is that you can always, if you can use projectors, you can keep projecting onto some such space while applying the Hamiltonian. And this will give you the lowest energy state on that subspace, as opposed to the full field of space. All right. And so any questions about this? OK, so the good news is that for the other exercise, for n equal to 20 spins, I just didn't want to do the same, so I didn't complete it for you. But the idea is again the same. So the exercise was compute the first excited state with momentum k equal to 0. So now we cannot use momentum. The ground state has momentum 0. Okay, the first excited state has the same momentum. So projecting onto zero momentum is not going to help us distinguish between that state and the ground state. But the idea is that you can orthogonal, you could imagine we have our state now that will depend on the iteration. Let's call it time. But we don't want this to be the ground state at any time, but the first excited state. That means we want it to be orthogonal to the ground state. So what we could do is to ensure step by step that this state remains orthogonal to the ground state. So the idea is that given the initial state, we can multiply it by h. Okay? But then we can make sure that it's orthogonal to the ground state by just projecting out the ground state contribution. Then we multiply it by h, we project out, and so on. So what we're saying is go lower and lower in energy, but always remain orthogonal to the ground state. So if you keep doing that, you lower the energy until you cannot lower it more, but the result has to be orthogonal to the ground state, so it's going to be the first excited. And so all you need to do is to implement this projector. Apart from multiplying the state with the Hamiltonian, we need to make it orthogonal to the ground state. And that's something that you can just, it's this idea that if you want, you have a state and you want to make it orthogonal to the ground state, what do? Well, you take the state and subtract some amount of ground state. And how much ground state do you need to subtract? Well, it's some number that it's going to be precisely this part. Okay? So indeed, if you have this expression, and now you ask, is this thing orthogonal to the ground state? Well, compute the ground state, the product, scalar product with the ground state. This times this will give you, right? So how much is this? Is this minus ground state with ground state. Scalar product of ground state with psi, but this we assume that this was equal to 1, and so this minus this could be 0. Okay, so that's a very simple way of ensuring that your state is orthogonal to the ground state. Just take your state and subtract an amount of ground state given by the scalar product between the ground state and the standard procedure. And if you do that, then and you add it to the loop, you'll be able to lower the energy of your state without by hitting it with a Hamiltonian but keeping orthogonal to the ground. So you'll get the first excited state. Very good. So I'm going to stop here. I wanted to mention that in general, you don't need to write all this code from scratch, that there is a lot. If what you want is to diagonalize, find the ground state, first excited state, and so on, you don't need to evolve by multiplying with the Hamiltonian step by step and see how the energy goes. I mean, this has been optimized for you. As a matter of fact, you can use the function ax. Usually in ax, we would put here the Hamiltonian. okay, and maybe the number of eigenvalues that we wanted and so on. But it turns out that if instead of putting the Hamiltonian, you put a, you provide a function that multiplies a vector times the Hamiltonian, then AX will know how to find the ground state and first excited state for you in an optimized way, in a way that it requires the minimum number of multiplications by the Hamiltonian. Okay? And this works nicely in Julia 0.6, and I have not been able to make it work for Julia 1.0, but that's me, not Julia. So there is a way to make it work, I just didn't know last night, so I left it. Very good. So this would be the end of this part of, besides what I want to tell you about next, this concludes the direct explanations about Julia. Remember that what you've learned is that if you work with quantum many-body systems, if they give you a quantum spin chain and you want to find the ground state or the lowest energy states, then you can use exact diagonalization. You can build this huge Hamiltonian. Okay? And we've discussed how to do that. And then you can diagonalize it. But we have also learned how to do it in a smarter way so that you can go to larger system sizes. So if you build a whole Hamiltonian, maybe you can go to 10, 12, 14 spins if you have a good computer. If you apply instead this method where you never build a Hamiltonian explicitly, the professionals exploiting symmetries and so on can make it, can go, here we went to 18, 20 spins, the true professionals can go to 40 spins nowadays, which is a lot. It's a lot. Okay? Very good. So, do you have any questions?
Good question.
Yes.
So, in the last part, you use normalized graph and also the function that you give the normalized back. I guess they're equivalent.
Sorry, again?
So, for the ground state, you use the function normalized, which is the built-in function.
Yes.
And then you use normalized back for excited state. I guess the function that you build is just equivalent with.
How did they? I don't know that this. Does this function exist?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. And so I. That was a major typo. So it exists, right? All right. So right. So I didn't realize that this. I meant to write this, and because normalize exists, I didn't notice that I had. Okay. Thank you. Any other embarrassing comment? Excellent. All right, so how do we go? So if there are no more questions, I want to tell you a little bit about my own research, which is how do we go beyond what we can do with exact diagonalization or all these tricks that only allow us to at most double the system size. And so, what's going on here? Okay, so what I want to do is to tell you about many-body entanglement and tensor networks, give you an introduction. So again, the setting here is that we want to go beyond these 40 qubits or 40 spins if we were professionals. If you are in this class, maybe 20 spins. So the answer is use tensor networks. And this is the result of insight that is exploiting some insight that came 10 years ago, 15 years ago, by studying many-body entanglement. So what I'm going to do is to tell you about, to remind you that we know quantum mechanics, we know the rules, we know how to write the Schrödinger equation, but that when we try to use that, we hit this computational challenge, that is that the computational cost grows exponentially in the system size. And then I'll tell you, I'll remind you of what we saw already a little bit, this area law for entanglement entropy, the idea that Gaon states of local Hamiltonians are much less entangled than generic states in the Hilbert space. That's something we saw last week. And finally, I'll tell you how we exploit this property, the fact that ground states are not very entangled, to efficiently parameterize these ground states and be able to study systems with hundreds, thousands, or even infinitely many spins. So part one, quantum mechanics and the many-body problem. Well, that's something that you already know very well. Since the 1920s or 30s, when quantum mechanics was developed, they understood how the quantum wall works. We have the Schrödinger equation. We just need to deal with the Hamiltonian of the system that typically we understand also well thanks to experiments. And then if we want to understand how the system will behave at any time, we just integrate this differential equation. And in general, in quantum matter, in condensed matter, what we're interested in is in understanding precisely what happens to quantum many-body systems when you put many of these quantum systems together, many spins, many electrons, how they organize themselves collectively. Okay? So we want to be able to study superfluids, superconductors, supersolid. The idea is you put together these basic ingredients and they organize themselves in many possible ways, some of which are exotic, some of which are useful. Maybe we can use topological order to build a quantum computer, and so on. Maybe we can design superconductors, high-temperature superconductors at room temperature, and then you know, have all these high-speed trains with no dissipation, etc. So it would be really, really great if we knew how to do that. But there is a problem. That's Paul Dirac, apparently. And he said, the fundamental laws necessary for the mathematical treatment of a large part of physics and the whole of chemistry are thus completely known. What he's saying is, we have the Schrödinger equation. We know the rules. Okay? So why don't we just use the rules and start designing these high-temperature superconductors at room temperature and so on, or build this topological media for quantum computers? So then he goes on and says, and the difficulty lies only in the fact that application of this law leads to equations that are too complex to be solved. So what he's saying is, yes, we know the rules. So you give me a quantum spin, 2, 3, okay, and I know how they evolve. I can predict anything. I can design the interactions between them. So I can have, you know, that is okay. We understand theoretically a small number of quantum systems. But what we really would like or need is to understand how quantum systems behave when we put really many together. Okay? And at that point, we cannot use this the Schrödinger equation because we don't know how to solve it. Just writing this equation in practice, this is a vector in an exponentially large vector space. It's too large. We cannot put it in memory. And that's a problem due to emergence. So it turns out that by studying how 2, 3, 20 spins, 40 spins behave, we will not learn how a million spins behave. Okay? There is a million spins can behave in a very, very different than, say, 40 spins. So even though we can study 20 or 40 spins, we will not learn what we wanted to learn, which is how a massive amount of spins would behave. Very good. And this was said in 1929. And it's very embarrassing that it's in 89, almost 90 years later, and we still have the same problem. All right, so what is exactly the problem we would like to be able to solve? So what we do is, Maybe the problem is more complicated. Maybe we want to study electrons on some solid background, on the background of the potential given by a solid for superconductivity. there are, you know, the details might be complicated, but what we do is we simplify those. Okay? And so typically what we do is we study a lattice model. Maybe quantum spins, maybe fermions. So this is already a simplification. And even the simplification, we have no clue how to solve. Okay? But let me describe the simplification briefly. So what we have is we have a lattice system. Each side has a spin 1/2 degree of freedom in the simplest possible version we can imagine. So each side would be on state up or down, okay? Or a linear combination of those. So if you want the first one on the top, you have a spin chain. And then we could also think of a spin lattice in two dimensions. And the problem we want to solve, or a simplified version of it, typically consists of having a nearest neighbor Hamiltonian, coupling nearest neighbor spins or sides on the top, and same thing here. These two spins talk to each other, these two spins talk to each other, and the same everywhere, the lattice. And this Hamiltonian could be very simple, could be a Heisenberg Hamiltonian. It's just saying the two spins should be aligned or anti-aligned, depending on the sign. So this is a very simple, you know, the very, it's a toy model, if you want. And so remember that what we discussed here is that the problem is that the dimension of the Hilbert space grows exponentially in the number of spins. So if I had just one spin, I have to account for two options, up and down. And the more general state requires two complex coefficients, C1 and C2. If I had two spins instead, there are four options. And so I would need to specify four complex coefficients in order to specify the state of the system. Okay, C1, C2, C3, C4. And then for three spins, 8 coefficients. For four spins, 16 coefficients. And don't ask me to write the next term because it's a pain. Okay, but you get the idea. So for n spins, we have this dimension 2 to the n. And that means that as we increase the number of spins, the dimension really goes up. So I find it useful to try to understand how bad this is. Is it, you know, you can always say, oh, don't worry, I'll buy a bigger computer. Okay, so let's have a look at how that would work. You want to buy a bigger computer. So here is a 16 times 16 spin lattice in two dimensions, so 256 spins. If you look at the dimension of this, 2 to the 256, apparently it's 10 to the 77 complex numbers. I don't know what that means. And so let's look at what we could do with the laptop. Okay? You take your laptop and you have memory 6 gigabytes. Maybe you can have better memory nowadays. I just didn't want to have to change my talk. So how much will this cover? Well, you have a look at that and it gives you 32 spins. Okay, so you know, this looks like no problem. If a laptop does this, then I get 8 laptops, right? And I'm done. But no, it's exponential growth. So what two laptops would allow you to do is store the state for the first 32 plus 1, 33. Okay? That would be two laptops. Four laptops would give you those spins plus two more. All right, so let's say no problem. I have a friend who works with supercomputers, and I can sneak in and use this computer for my calculation. Well, bad news. This will only allow you to deal with 48 spins. So then you go crazy and say, okay, fine, you win. But imagine, you know, I just wait a few more years, and they'll build this super big computer, and I can do that, no problem. So let's see, I don't think that's the case. So let's try to quantify it. So imagine that we can use a human-sized computer by turning every single atom in your body into a memory to store one bit, okay? So this would be a computer that takes every single atom in your body. Apparently, we have 10 to the 28 atoms in our body. And uses that to store a bit of information. And now we look at how powerful this computer would be. Okay, and it says, no, sorry, not enough memory yet. So then we say, okay, no problem. We can build a bigger computer. We just take all the atoms on Earth, okay, and we store one bit of information on each atom, and we can get bigger computer. Well, yes, bigger, but not enough. So you say, well, no problem. Why should we stop with the Earth? All right, there is the solar system waiting for us to turn it into a computer. Oh, that's bad. Not enough. Okay. So why to stop there? We take the whole Milky Way, all the matter in the Milky Way, and we turn it into a computer. And then, oh, sorry, not big enough. And I was getting really desperate, but then I learned that if we take the whole observable universe, it would be big enough to cover our lattice. Okay?
It's a thousand times bigger.
It's bigger than that?
No, it's a thousand times bigger. It's really, really bigger.
Sorry, I don't get.
I mean, 10 to the 80, and you need 10 to the 70.
Oh, it's bigger. Yes.
No problem.
Oh, yeah, it's too big.
Yes.
Yeah. So what's the problem, right? Very good. So yeah, so that's the idea, right? That it doesn't matter, you can wait. Technology can improve, okay? You won't be able to store a wave function for this system anytime soon, right? Good. So what I wanted to tell you then is about a proposed solution to this problem. It comes under the name of tensor network states. And where I want to start by telling you is that we won't be able to store the wave function of the whole system. We will only be able to store the wave function of the whole system under the assumption that it has certain properties. Okay? So, and these properties will coincide with the states that can be represented by using some tensor networks that I'll describe later. The idea is, though, that this is going to be a variational approach. We pre-assume that the wave function of the system is of certain type. Okay? But the good news is that it's biased. So this means that we all can only look at certain wave functions. But the good news is that these wave functions are general. The class of wave functions we can look at is general enough that it contains all ground states of local Hamiltonians. That, you know, regardless of the Hamiltonian you wanted to study, this tensor network is going to be able to represent the ground state. So we will give up generality, but we'll still be fine because everything that we wanted to study will be contained in this variational class. All right, so how do we get there? To get to that, to explain what tensor networks are, I need to tell you about this area law for entanglement entropy, and luckily we saw a manifestation of it last week already. So remember what I told you, that we had a bipartite system with parts A and B. We defined a product state as a state of A and B that factorized as a state of A and the state of B. And the example, a typical example, would be each spin is pointing up. And then I also told you that we say that the state is entangled if it doesn't factorize in this way. And an example, typical example, would be linear combination of spin up down for A and B, and then down up. Okay? You cannot write it as a state for A and state for B anymore. And then remember that it was a bit tricky sometimes to figure out whether a state was entangled or a product state, but we established that this was a product state because it was, do I have it here? Hope I have it. Yeah. Because it can be rewritten. You can group all these terms into up plus down for A and up plus down for B. Okay. What else did we see? So we saw that if we wanted to find out, in general, if a state is entangled, we could look at the reduced density matrix. So this was this object that we can build from the wave function. So we have the wave function psi AB expanded in all those coefficients. And what we could do is we could trace out part B. That's something we discussed in detail during the class. But it basically boils down to the reduced object for part A that you need if all you want to ask is questions about part A. So you want to compute the expectation value of an observable on part A, say the magnetization of the spin and so on, without looking at B. This reduced density matrix is the mathematical object that quantum mechanics tells you you should be looking at. And the conclusion was that a state, bipartite state psi AB, is entangled if and only if rho has some entropy or some way we say it's mixed. Okay? So if you want to know whether your bipartite state psi AB is entangled, trace out B, look at part A, the reduced density matrix, and ask whether it has entropy or it doesn't. So this entropy also allows us to quantify how entangled this state is. And so let's run an example. So if we said before this state was entangled, okay, then let's have a look at what happens when we trace par B. When we trace par B, this option is orthogonal to this one, so we end up with a density metric, which is a mixture of spin up and spin down with coefficients 1/2 and 1/2. This is already the eigenvalue decomposition. And from here, we can compute the entropy. The entropy would be putting this P alpha will be 1/2 for both options. When you do it, you get an EBIT of entanglement. So this state is indeed entangled. If we started with the product state instead, as we said, it wasn't entangled, and you do the same calculation, when you trace out part B, you end up with a projection on part A. That's the eigenvalue decomposition is with eigenvalues 1 and 0. When you put those values here, you get 0 entropy. Okay, so this works. So we have this measure, this quantity that we can compute, and then automatically know whether our state is entangled or not. Okay, so why am I telling you all this? Well, I'm telling you all this because this was a theory that was being developed 20 years ago now in quantum information to characterize certain ability to process entangled states to accomplish things like quantum teleportation. So there was a motivation for that in terms of quantum information. But there is a question you can ask that only a posteriori turns out to be a very good question. So you could ask, why not? If you had a spin chain, which is infinite, and it's in the ground state, okay? Suppose it's in the ground state of the Hamiltonian, and you trace out all the spins in part B, and you just look at the spins in part A, you can ask how much is the entropy of this region, okay? You could ask this question. I mean, it sounds like some random question you could ask. So it is, at this point, a random question, but let's ask it. So we look at how much entanglement we have between part A and the rest of the spin chain. We could ask the same question when we had a two-dimensional lattice, right? We divide the infinite two-dimensional lattice into region A and the rest of the spin, and ask how much entropy we have there when the whole system is in the ground state. And because we like asking random questions, here's another question. How does this entanglement entropy scale with L? Okay. Again, why do you ask this? I don't know. You know, people were trying to find out questions, and somebody asked this one. Okay. And so suddenly, the answer to this question made this question very important. Okay. So it turns out that the answer to this question, how does the entropy scale as you increase the size of the region, depends on what type of state you start from. We said, let's look at this for the ground state. But let's ask first the question, what if we start with a generic random state in the whole Hilbert space? Okay? So you use this rand n, this generator of random numbers, and you produce a wave function for all the spins, completely random wave function. Then it turns out that the amount of entropy that you will find in part A will depend on the size of part A, meaning it will be proportional to the number of spins in part A. That's what happened generically, okay? When you have a completely random wave function. But when you ask the same question, when you look at the scaling for ground states of local Hamiltonians, you find a completely different answer. Okay. Instead of having this volume law, where the amount of entanglement depends on the size of the whole region. When the state is a ground state, and you trace out B, the entropy in A is no longer proportional to the number of spins inside. It's only proportional to the number of spins at the boundary of A. Okay? So it's an area law. Yes?
If the wave function is just a random wave function, there will be no entanglement between different points. So the entanglement entropy should be zero.
Why do you say that there won't be any entanglement between different points?
They're random states.
So what I'm saying is choose one particular random state, right? You generate 2 to the n numbers, random numbers, complex numbers. That's a wave function. Yes?
Just the wave function is random. That doesn't mean the 2 points.
Okay, so I'm informing you that but you did this experiment in class. No, I don't need to inform you. I was going to say, if you do that, you'll find that the amount of entanglement grows proportional to the system size. But you did that last week, and I'll just remind you of it. Remember that we had this plot where we were plotting the entropy S of L as a function of the number of spins? Remember? And you found this line and maybe a little bit of saturation on the top. And when we did this for the ground state, it looked like that. It's in one of the notebooks. So that's what I mean. This thing here, the L is the number of spins inside the region A, and the entropy is proportional to L, to the number of spins inside the region A. That's what is called volume. All right, so here is something amazing, because you know what we are saying is we need 2 to the n parameters, exponentially many parameters, to represent an arbitrary wave function. But it turns out that the questions we really want to be able to answer are about ground states of local Hamiltonians. It's the questions we want to answer is not about some random wave function. And so by seeing this, that ground states systematically behave differently, that gives the idea, oh, then maybe, sure, we cannot efficiently parametrize a random wave function, but maybe we can efficiently parametrize ground states. They are behaving in a different way. And an entanglement might be the key. Okay? The different way means that they are entangled in a different way. All right. And specifically, this area law, what's telling you, trying to tell you, is that this entanglement occurs at the boundary of the region that you are considering. Okay? It doesn't see the interior. So it must be something, it's about correlations between the spins on both sides of the boundary, not far in the interior. Okay? That explains that the entropy only collects contributions that go proportional to the boundary, to the size of the boundary. All right. So we have this area law. It's been documented in 1, 2, 3 dimensions, arbitrary dimensions for a number of cases. You can do field theory calculations that are consistent with that.
Did you test it only for kind of ground states, for type independent solutions? Also, in cases where there's some time evolution, some hyperbolic system.
Hyperbolic system, huh?
Time evolution.
So, this is about ground states, and if you try to do, actually, the assignment will be about time evolution. And seeing, yeah, there will be an assignment for those lucky enough to need an assignment for the course. And they will have to look at how the entanglement grows during a time evolution. And the conclusion there is that there is no area law. You go back to a volume law after some time. So the amount of entanglement depends on time, right? The state is changing over time. And this amount of entanglement will start growing. And if you started with some area law state that fulfills the area law, say the ground state, and you change a little bit the Hamiltonian, so that the if you start from the ground state and you evolve according to the Hamiltonian, nothing happens. It's the ground state. But if you change a little bit the ground, the Hamiltonian, then the evolution will be non-trivial, and you'll go from a state that has this area law for entanglement to a state that has a volume law. And that's the assignment. All right. Oh, you will not end up with the ground state. You'll end up with infinite temperature mixed state. Well, it's pure state, but it looks like a thermal. All right. So it turns out that there are sometimes tiny corrections. So instead of having this area law, we have an area law times some logarithmic correction. It's just a little bit more than the area law. And that's precisely what we saw, the difference that we saw between, if you remember, this was a random state. And then there were two possibilities. The ground state for the critical system had a bit more entanglement than the ground state for the gap system. Okay, the gap system had less entanglement. The critical one, actually, this critical one already has a logarithmic correction to the area law. And so the conclusion is this, that ground states of local Hamiltonians are not random states in the Hilbert space, but very special ones. So we can graphically represent it like this. We say this is the whole Hilbert space. Okay, this would be a generic state anywhere. And ground states of local Hamiltonians occupy a tiny corner of this Hilbert space. And they are characterized by not obeying the volume law, but the area law. Very good. And for later reference, let me elaborate a little bit more on this as a function of the dimension. So if we consider a system, a Hamiltonian, where there is a finite energy gap between the ground state energy, or the ground state and the first excited state, so we call this a gap system. Okay, that would be for us the Ising model away from criticality. Then we always see the area law, which means that in one dimension, the area law means that the amount of entropy is constant with respect to the size of the region. So that's why we had, in one dimension, as a function of the size of the region, the entropy would be constant. Okay, that's what we saw when we studied the ground state of the Ising model of criticality. In two dimensions, the area law means growth as L, L squared in three dimensions. L here is the linear size of the region A. But if the system is gapless, then things might be a bit different. So if the system is gapless, but there are not many zero modes, maybe that's a bit technical. As for those of you who know about Fermi surfaces, it's codimension two or larger. Then we still have the area law. And for systems with more gapless modes, then we will have this logarithmic correction. This, as I said, it's just for later reference. Okay? Don't think too hard about it. All right, finally, we can go to these tensor networks. We're ready for it. Okay, do you have any question before that? Yeah?
Are the ground states in mechanics?
Sorry?
Are the ground states of Hamiltonian systems so important?
Very good. So I don't know how to answer this question in full generality, but it turns out that if you understand the ground state of a quantum system, you typically also understand the properties of that system when it's at a low temperature. Okay? So if you have the ground state of a quantum system is the same as the vacuum of quantum field theory. So the field theory is really also heavily influenced by the properties of the vacuum. Here, the properties of the ground state organize the behavior typically of the system also at when it's not in the ground state. Okay, so for instance, if the system is so-called topologically ordered, the ground state will reflect this, and all the excitations will behave in an exotic way, but that already can be seen from the ground state. If the ground state, if you are at criticality, where there is no mass gap, you know, you would say, oh, not having a mass gap is a property of the relation between ground state and first excited state. But the ground state knows already. The ground state displays power law decay of correlation. So typically, or very often, by understanding the ground state, you already understand what. All right. So remember, what's the problem? We want to represent a wave function of n spins. And this is given by psi I1, I2, IN, all these coefficients. And I already introduced in class this notation, graphical notation, where this tensor psi I1, I2, IN, which is a tensor with n indices, will represent it with a circle or a square, a plot, and then one leg representing each index. In this case, we would have n indices, n legs. Now, a tensor network will be a way of re-expressing this object in this form. And now I want to spend a minute explaining what that means. So remember what we explained during the class, that if I wanted the matrix, I would just represent a circle, represent it with a circle with two legs. A vector would be a circle with one leg. A complex number would be just a circle. A rank 3 tensor would be a circle with 3 legs. And the other rule is that if you see two tensors and there is an index that they share, a leg that goes from one from the other, that means that we are multiplying this index. Okay, so this thing here is equal to a matrix, okay, because there is a sum over this index. So this is just the graphical notation for this expression here, which is matrix-matrix multiplication. We have a matrix, we have another matrix, right, with coefficient rik and sk. And what we do is we sum over k, right, the intermediate index. So if you see a drawing like this, that's a matrix-matrix multiple. Similarly, if you would see a drawing like that, well, let's spell it out, right? What's this? This is a vector, has one leg. This is another vector, it has one leg. This is a matrix, has two legs. And so what this is a matrix multiplied by a vector and by a vector, right? It's of this form. And the result is a number, and indeed, that's what we write on the other side. A circle with no legs, that's just a number. Okay? Because you are looking so focused, I want to ask you, what is this? What is this representing?
Trace.
The trace. Trace of what?
Of four legs.
Does everybody agree? The trace of these four matrices. Okay? And finally, if I look at something like this, I have four tensors. Each tensor has 3 legs. There is some pattern of contraction. What's important here, the first thing you have to notice is how many open legs we have. There are 3 open legs. So I don't know exactly what this is, but the result is a tensor with 3 legs. Okay? So I multiply 3 small tensors together. Each one has an open leg, so the result is single tensor with 3 legs. Okay? Very good. So I think we're ready. Is that clear? Question? Okay, so now we are ready to go back to that. Let's have a look at this. What is this? Anybody? It's a beautiful drawing. What else? What do you see? Many tensors, many small tensors. I call them small because each one has 3 legs, 4 legs, not many, small number of legs. Then they are multiplied together, right? Some pattern, according to some network pattern. And how many open legs do you see? Well, thanks for you need to use the imagination, but yes, this means n. Okay? So the idea is that if we multiply all these tensors together according to the network pattern, we get a single big tensor with n legs. Okay? And that's exactly what we have on the other side. But the advantage of this is that we have small tensors. Each tensor has two indices, three indices, four indices, but you know, not a number of indices that scales with n. Okay? So why is this interesting? Well, let's count parameters. We have, if you look at how many tensors we have on the order of n tensors. And each one has a number of indices p, maybe four indices, three indices. And each index runs over some number of values. So remember, each tensor will have some number of complex coefficients. In this case, chi to the p. Okay? So what happened? The question is, let's count parameters on this side. On this side, we have a number of parameters that is 2 to the n. This is the problem we keep saying, hey, too many parameters. I don't know how to put this in my laptop. 2 to the n, for large n, that's a big problem. On the right-hand side, we have a number of parameters which is proportional to the number of tensors. Okay? If we assume that each tensor has a number of parameters that does not depend on the system size. So in particular, let's think for a second of what happens if we want to study not n spins, but n plus 1 spins. Okay? So on the left-hand side, we add a leg. If we add one leg there, the number of parameters multiplied by 2. Okay? On the right-hand side, if we add one leg, we need to add a couple of tensors. So the number of parameters grows by 2 times whatever the number. It's some number, right? Whatever parameters we have plus some number. So on the right-hand side, on the left-hand side, we have to multiply by 2 the number of parameters. On the right-hand side, we just add some. Okay? So that means that the number of parameters indeed grows proportional to the system size here, whereas it is exponential in there. Is that clear? This is probably one of the most important. So ask questions if you have any. Okay, so what's happening there? What's happening is, well, this cannot be always true, right? Left and right cannot always be the same. Because how can we represent exponentially many parameters with order n parameters? What's happening here is that with this type of decomposition, this decomposition is not always valid. Not all wave functions can be decomposed. But if we have a wave function that can be decomposed in this way, then we'd better use this decomposition because it's much more efficient. Okay? It will only take order n parameters. So again, we have the generic space, the space of all the big Hilbert space of all the vectors. And what we're finding is that only a subclass of them, small corner again, can be represented in this way. So we have an efficient representation of only a subset of wave functions. We can only efficiently parameterize a small corner of the Hilbert space. But this language sounds familiar, right? That's what I was saying before. The ground states of local Hamiltonian also are only a subset, a little corner of the Hilbert space.
The n in this is it the same as the n?
Yes.
Right.
No, I'm saying imagine that the number of tensors is proportional to n. Maybe 2n or 3n. Okay? Basically, the width does not grow with n or in a very mild. So I'm saying we have two situations that look a bit parallel. On the one hand, we had ground states are a small corner of the Hilbert space. On the other hand, we have some efficient parameterization for a small subset of wave functions. And this doesn't imply that tensor network states are a good representation of ground states. Okay? It's not an implication there, but it's suggestive. Okay? And so I didn't prove anything yet, but there is this potential connection between the two. Okay. So tensor networks in general, but in practice, actually, we do not use tensor networks, arbitrary tensor networks. We use specific tensor networks. There are good reasons to use those. Two examples of tensor networks that we use to represent ground states of quantum spin chains, so in one dimension. Two examples would be first the matrix product state, MPS, where you can see all the tensors are connected into a one-dimensional array. So there is one tensor per spin, right? Each open index corresponds to a spin. And we have one tensor per spin. Okay. So this is a case where the number of sites or spins and the number of tensors will be exactly the same. Another tensor network that we also use for one-dimensional systems, it's called multi-scale entanglement renormalization ansatz, or MIRA. And in this case, again, the open indices are down here, and we're representing a ground state of a spin chain, as before. But this time, the tensors, instead of just being distributed in one dimension, they also extend in a second dimension. Okay? So it's like using a two-dimensional ansatz to represent a one-dimensional state. But okay, there we are. And now it turns out that these two representations, MPS and MIRA, have a very interesting property. If you look at how much entanglement, so suppose that you have a wave function that can be written as a matrix product state, and you can ask how much entanglement is in this wave function. Well, it turns out that you can upper bound this entanglement by looking at how many indices you have to cut. So the question is how much entanglement is there in region, or how much entropy we have in region A, okay? And the answer, so region A is a subset of the spin, and how much entanglement is there if the wave function can be represented in this way, turns out that the answer is, at most, the amount of entanglement is proportional to how many indices you have to cut to separate your region from the rest of the tensor network. Okay? And the smallest number of indices that you have to cut in this case is 2. It's a constant. It's independent of the system size, of the region A. Okay? And that is already an area law. So it turns out that the matrix product state has built in the area law. Okay? If you have a wave function that can be expressed as a matrix product state, this wave function obeys an area law. And this is just as ground states of gap systems in 1D. So now we start to see similarities here between the class of tensor networks and the properties of the ground states in one dimension. In this case, it's gap ground states of Hamiltonians with an energy gap. If we look at MIRA instead, and we ask the same question, what's the entropy on region A? The answer again is at most, the entropy is given at most by the smallest number of indices that you have to cut to split the tensor network into two parts, one containing A and the rest. And if you look at all possible cuts, there is another cut here or around, the smallest one is when it goes like this. And if you count how many indices you have to cut as a function of the size L of A, it gives you a logarithm, okay? Logarithm of the size of A. But that's precisely this logarithmic correction to the area law. So this is precisely the scaling of entanglement entropy in ground states of critical systems. Okay? So now we're starting to see some more coherent picture emerging. We had ground states in one dimension, could obey the area law, or could have a logarithmic violation of the area law. And we have these two tensor networks, each of which reproduces the same scaling of entanglement entropy, either a constant, which is the area law in one dimension, or a logarithmic correction. Okay? So that's a hint that maybe this ansatz will be good for ground states. It's not a proof, okay? But it makes it more plausible. Okay, so in general, we have this matrix product state that we can generalize to two dimensions and has some name projected entangled parastates or PEPs. And what we do here again is to attach one tensor to each spin and then connect the tensors according to the way the spins are connected on the lattice. Okay, nearest name. So again, just a drawing, but look at this. Same way that in one dimension, when I try to break this sensor network into two pieces, I need to break a number of connections there. I can ask how many connections I need to break in the PEPS. Okay? So in one dimension, we saw that the number of connections we had to break was 2, independent of the size L of the region. Okay? It's always 2. And that was the area law. So what's going to happen here? We take a region, square region of linear size L, and we ask how many connections we need to break in the network, and we get, well, it's proportional to L. It's the area law again. Okay? So these tensor networks naturally reproduce the area law in any dimension. And similarly, we just saw this, that we can reproduce the area law in two dimensions with the PEPS. And you can ask whether you can generalize MERA also to higher dimensions to reproduce the logarithmic correction to the area law. And it turns out that you can generalize MERA, but it will not give you the logarithmic correction. There is some other tensor network called branching MERA, which will give you the logarithmic correction. Okay? So this is just so that we can go back to the table we saw before, where we studied, where we classify as a function of the space dimension, one dimension, spin chain, two dimensions, three dimensions. We had gap systems, we had gapless systems, and we were looking at the scaling of entanglement. And it turns out that for each type of entanglement, scaling of entanglement, we have a tensor network that can reproduce. Okay? So each type of ground state, for each type of ground state, we have one of these tensor networks. So in one dimension, for gap systems, we have the matrix product state. For two-dimensional system, we have PEPS. For three dimensions, we also have PEPS, three-dimensional PEPS, which I didn't draw. And similarly, we have MERA and branching MERA to cover all the different possibilities. Okay? So the first stage was to characterize how entanglement scales in ground states. That happened maybe 15 years ago. And the second stage was to build tensor networks that could efficiently represent wave functions with the same scaling of entanglement. And importantly, I didn't prove that these tensor networks are a good representation for ground states. I cannot prove that. That's an empirical observation. When you start using these tensor networks and you try to get ground state energies, it turns out that these tensor networks allow you to represent the ground state. It doesn't follow from anything I said. I could only provide motivation. But in the end, it's just an empirical observation. Very good. So it turns out that this tensor network business started started in the context of trying to simulate spin chains and lattice models in higher dimensions. And it's a it's a nice story. It's a successful story. There is a lot of work to be done still, especially in two dimensions. We need to improve the technique. This has been the effort by several hundreds of researchers. But in the end, this tensor network is just a sparse data structure. So even though we started by trying to understand ground states of local Hamiltonians, what we obtain is an official representation of vectors in a huge Hilbert space, in a huge vector space. And that's not just the structure that you have in quantum spin change. It's a setting that you have more generally. So what happened is that, starting with computational condensed matter, we developed these techniques, but then they started to be useful for other reasons. One is, instead of numerics, it was used already still in quantum matter to classify gap phases. So it turns out that this is a natural representation. It's not just a trick. It's a natural way of representing ground states. Okay? And once this was understood, instead of being just tools for numerical calculations, they started to be used as tools for, say, a classification. So that's more analytical work, no numeric symbol. it is also of interest for material science to design new materials. For quantum chemistry, it turns out that, of course, there they also have similar problem with the growing exponentially large Hilbert space. But it turns out that, you know, the same techniques suddenly were useful also for classical statistical mechanics to study the renormalization group, or even in string theory for holography. Okay, so nowadays holographers in string theory use tensor networks. And we had the colloquium yesterday about machine learning. So tensor networks are a big thing in machine learning today, and also data compression. Okay? And so what I wanted to do is to end just mentioning four of these applications briefly so that you know in which sense these tensor networks can be used more broadly than just quantum matter. But the first application is just to say, OK, let's look at the original motivation, original approach to quantum many-body systems. The idea is that these tools, you know, if you want to study a many-body system, you may want to use Monte Carlo. We had the second module of this course was about Monte Carlo techniques, sampling techniques. The problem when you try to use Monte Carlo or sampling techniques in quantum systems is the so-called sign problem. It's the fact that amplitudes don't have to be positive in quantum mechanics. If they are not all positive, then you have cancellations between positive and negative values, and Monte Carlo techniques do not converge. Okay, so that's the famous sign problem that prevents using Monte Carlo to study, say, theories of interacting fermions. And there are many models in quantum matter that cannot be addressed with Monte Carlo. And so tensor networks appeared as a new technique that didn't have this problem of the sign problem. Okay? And it's not every day that, you know, some numerical approach makes it to science, but there are exceptions. And for instance, this is from 2011, where Jan, Hughes, and White addressed some long-standing open problem in which is a lattice model in two dimensions, a Kagome lattice. So you have quantum spins, as we've been discussing, but in two dimensions. And they use tensor networks to attack this problem. This was based on a matrix product state that was used in two dimensions in a funny way. Or this classification of phases of matter, which again made it to science the next year. This was work done in part here at Perimeter by Xiaoyang Wen and collaborators. And so the idea again is that you can use these tensor networks to represent ground states, not just numerically, but also analytically. Very good. So then closer to activity that is at Perimeter, where there is a lot of talking about holography, and it turns out that these tensor networks suddenly were also being paid attention in the context of holography. There's some common. So the question there is whether Mera is a lattice realization of the famous ADS-CFT correspondence of string theory. This is the famous ADS-C correspondence proposed by Juan Maldacena in 1987 that says that quantum field theory in a number of dimensions is dual to a theory of quantum gravity in one extra dimension. Okay. Is any of you aware of holography here? I would need to know that. Yes? Aware. Aware is enough. Okay, very good. So the idea is that we are dealing with two objects. They live in different dimensions, right? If you want, the field theory lives at the boundary of this cylinder, whereas the pure quantum gravity lives inside. And it turns out that, this object here, this Mera, this is the Mera or the tensor. Mera tensor network, look from the top. Turns out that it's describing at the boundary, it's describing the ground state of a critical spin chain. But this is the lattice version of a quantum field theory, of a conformal field theory. Okay? So we have an object that stands in an extra dimension, as in holography, and has a conformal field theory at the boundary, as in holography. Okay? So That led Brian Swingle in 2009, so almost 10 years ago, to propose that this tensor network was a lattice version of ADS-CFT. We should understand it as a time slice of anti-de-Sitter 3. What he was saying is, sure, we know that this is preparing the ground state of a CFT at the boundary, but the tensor network itself extends in an extra dimension, and that would be the theory of quantum gravity. Now, this is a very loose claim. There were counter claims by other authors saying, yes, MERA is a realization of ADS-CFT, but instead of representing a time slice of ADS-3, it represents some integral transform of that, something else. Okay? There was a debate on how exactly MERA enters holography. And this is still going on. And there is a third, well, now there is a proposal that MERA is yet a third geometry, none of this. That's something I'm trying to finish these days. So it's still an open question. And finally, current applications. The fourth one I wanted to mention is machine learning. And we had a colloquium, a great colloquium, Wednesday, 2 days ago. Oh, time flies. So in machine learning, what we try to do is we try to train a neural network. For instance, we could train a neural network to recognize digits from 0 to 9, which has inputs from learning data set. And then we use this deep, we could use a deep neural network where we need to train all these connections between circles so that the next time we present them with somebody's representation of a digit, the neural network decides, oh, this is a 9 or 7. And if you look at this, this is just a drawing. And it might look like a tensor network. And this is really, really misleading, because it is not a tensor network. Or the language that is being used, the graphical language that is being used here, is really different from tensor network. So here, the tensors would be the lines, and the indices would be the circles. Okay? So that led to so much confusion, because suddenly tensor networks were useful for machine learning, but every time that you would look at the drawing, you need to know, okay, what's the convention? What am I looking at?
There is a deep reason, or is it just for fun?
Fun is not the reason for sure, because it's not been fun. But it just happens that if you have a setting where all your tensors are matrices, and this is what's happening here, there are matrices, only two indices for us, then you can choose whatever representation you want. And because each index talks to many others through different matrices, that's a natural way of encoding that. Okay? It's just, actually, I would call it bad luck, because it makes it very confusing. But it turns out that after some very serious effort, some authors, for instance, these guys here, managed to establish true connection between deep convolutional networks and this tensor network, which would be a free tensor network. So indeed, you can use tensor networks for machine learning, and you can try to take ideas from machine learning and bring them to tensor networks. Okay? Very good. So I'm done. Summary is that we've known for many years, for 90 years, the rules of quantum mechanics. But when we try to apply them in practice to microscopic systems, to many body systems made of many, many particles, quantum particles, then we have a very serious computational problem. The Hilbert space dimension grows exponentially in the system size. Then I told you about this area law for many body entanglement. It turns out that, again, 15 years ago, we started studying seriously entanglement in many body systems, and we realized the ground states of many body systems obey this area law. And that makes them very special states. Maybe we can efficiently simulate them, even though we cannot efficiently represent an arbitrary state. And then the third part, I told you that we have Being able to use this insight, this area law, to build tensor networks that reproduce this area law, and then not, and then check that indeed they are good representations of grounds. All right, thank you. Yeah. So this is it. It's okay. No, it's a bit early.